I think I have to really introduce it. The August Kong professor for social epistemology at the University of Warwick, that he's known for at least social epistemology, and also great books on Thomas Kuhn, controversial reviews about books such as Lord Smale. And at least at that, he's going to talk about the brain, a case of life, but not as we know it.
Okay, thank you very much, Max and Suparna, for inviting me to this. I think this is a very exciting conference. I'm always interested in the future because, you know, the past you can't do anything about. But what I want to start off by saying, having listened to all the papers so far, is that I think there's a real issue here about how humanists should be placing themselves with regard to neuroscience. And maybe this is a question that arises with science more generally, but one thing I want to put forward a kind of model, perhaps, that we can think about, not necessarily that we can fully discuss now, but for those of you, since there are a lot of younger people in the audience, and especially those of you who are in the history and philosophy of science, which is the field that I come from. How to think about the sciences and what your relationship is, because there seem to be two kind of standard relationships to the science. One of them, which I have not seen here demonstrated, but is very common, especially among the philosophy of science, is the under-laborer role, whereby what you're doing is providing conceptual clarification for the sciences as they are developing, where you take as given that the sciences as they are currently constituted are legitimate. Okay, and so most of the things that we talk about as passing for philosophy of physics, philosophy of biology, philosophy of psychology, philosophy of cognitive science, whatever, is of that character, where basically what the philosophers are doing, not so much the historians, but mostly the philosophers, are engaged in a kind of conceptual clarification, because in a sense, the humanistic disciplines do not provide direction to the sciences in any kind of clear way. Now, I raise this point because I think there's an issue that Mark perhaps has raised most clearly is about the future of the university and the relationship between the humanities and the natural sciences within that. And it seems to me that for quite a long time, maybe for as long as a century, it's been a case of the humanities taking the marching orders from the natural sciences, in which case then the under-laborer world makes sense, right? In a sense, the natural sciences are providing the vanguard of knowledge, and what the humanists do is kind of tidy up the loose ends, and perhaps by providing conceptual clarification, but also in the historical case, by providing historical legitimation. Now, not to preempt anything that Stephen Casper might say in any general discussion, but I do think that there is always a worry on the side of the historians on this, that if you give, as it were, too long a historical lead to what's currently happening in science, you can too easily legitimate it. You know, so for example, if you say all the issues that we're talking about in neuroscience today have been talked about for the last two centuries, then in a sense, even though in a sense you're denying the novelty of it, you're increasing the legitimacy of it. Okay, and so one has to be very careful about that kind of role, and historians often do play that kind of role. So there is this under-laborer role that humanities play with regard to the natural sciences. And I think that particular role, in terms of the collective memory of those of us who are in the history and philosophy of science, I would attribute that to Thomas Kuhn. And Max kindly mentioned the fact that I wrote this very critical book about Kuhn's impact 10 years ago now. There, where you talk about science as something having to be governed by a paradigm, and that is really sort of the vanguard of knowledge, and then if you take that as a given, then what you don't do, then there's never really a legitimate space from which to criticize an existing science from the outside. Right? What you do is you sort of provide an internal kind of critical discussion, and the under-laborer role fits that very nicely. Now, there's this more kind of external critique role, which I have seen exhibited in this conference a lot, and it seems to be kind of the default mode in which historians fall into with regard to neuroscience. And there it's not so much about referring to the previous history of neuroscience or whether it's been anticipated elsewhere, but some of the issues that have been coming up increasingly as we've talked about this is the complicity with neoliberalism, for example. And the degree to which it is contributing to the breakdown of the academy, as you were saying. And there it seems to me, while perhaps true, it might not necessarily be the most effective way in which the humanities can present itself as a form of knowledge that wants to uphold the values of the university. In other words, I tend to see this external critique thing as the second moment of a dialectic. Whereas it were, you have a sort of a standing position, so you have, as it were, the taken-for-granted science, the science in itself, as it were, if you're talking Hegel language, right? And then there is the critique, which is the kind of thing that I think most people in this room would be in default, by default, into. But then there's this third stage, where you go forward, right? Where in some sense, you're helping the science that's in itself in the first moment, right, forward, because in a sense, you have an investment in some way in that science. And here we're talking about neuroscience going forward into the future. And you want it to go forward into the future in the most comprehensive, you know, and most, whatever, socially appropriate way as possible. And that's the kind of standpoint from which I come from in this. Because in terms of a lot of the discussions we've had here, and maybe Roger will be referring to this, I'm not as critical as a lot of people have been of the neuroscience turn. And in fact, I've been rather supportive of neurohistory, which maybe Roger will talk about in more detail. This is the thing associated with Daniel Smale. It is the idea of saying that changes to our neurology and the way our brains work have been very important in terms of determining the way in which human history has worked, in conjunction with other things, you know, sort of as part of a kind of big history, kind of macro history perspective, but nevertheless a very important part. And so certain kinds of step changes may have occurred as a result of the introduction of, let's say, caffeine as on a mass level in the 18th century, or spirits in the 18th century as well. And that the idea of the Enlightenment, you know, as a kind of a case when people got illuminated might not just be because of the ideas people were talking about, but the sort of stuff they were grooving on. Okay? Because the ideas, in a sense, had been around for a while, but why is it that those ideas suddenly become catalysts and propellants for people to do something about stuff? Well, maybe it has to do with other things in their diet. Right? Because there are a lot of ideas that we hear, and we hear about them, you know, in conferences like this, which sound kind of interesting and entertaining, but nobody is ever willing to take action on them. And so they just sort of languish. But every now and then, people do take action on them. And it seems to me that one of the things that may be involved is the kind of the state of mind, the state of alertness, the state of readiness, and there are issues like the nutrients and the drugs and things that people are taking does matter, especially if we're talking about a critical mass of people at a particular time taking the same thing. And so this is why the introduction of coffee houses and pubs and things like this in the 18th century might turn out to be quite salient to explaining the Enlightenment, right? Whereas the ideas themselves had been around maybe for a century or two earlier. But the 18th century becomes salient because that's the point where all this stuff starts to become embodied. So this is the way in which I think of the endorsement of neurohistory, in a way, not as some kind of singular reductionist explanation for everything, but I do think that if one of the things we're concerned about in intellectual history is timing, because I think in a sense, all intellectual historians are by default Platonists. They believe the ideas have been around forever, and that's why it's always easy for an intellectual historian to sound clever by mentioning, well, that idea was around before, this is not new. Of course it was not new, but why do people act on it now rather than later? Then you want to look at other things, when the ideas become salient, when the ideas become vivid. And of course there are social and other cultural conditions, I don't want to deny those things. But as it were, the kind of responsiveness of people, the preparedness of people to do this. I do think that there's something to be said about the role that nutrients and drugs and things like that play, especially if we're talking about something happening at a collective level in a particular period of time. So I do think there's something to this neurohistory thing, and so I've been supportive of that. That's just by way of positioning myself with regard to this debate. Because of course I think we should be critical of neuro stuff if all we're talking about is reductionism in that kind of vague sense that everybody's against. But I'm not sure whether in detail we would all agree on what we're opposed to here. But I want to move on and talk about what is the positive role then for the humanist in all this. And I would like to propose a different sort of analogy here. Let's see. All right. The relationship between the historian or philosopher of neuroscience with regard to the neuroscientist should be that of director to actor. Okay, now think about this for a moment, please. This is the point here. Because in a sense, insofar as neuroscience does have general kind of cultural validity, it is because of the narratives told about it, because as we all admit in this room, there's not all that much around, it's very dispersed, and people don't know what it is at a first-hand level. But of course, what people do understand is the way that it plays into larger cultural narratives that then legitimate other things happening in society, and there, historians in particular play a very important kind of role. Now, what are historians doing when they're engaged in that kind of process? They're like directors, and often the directors are script writers as well. And what they do is they see in the actor a lot of potential. So you think about the way in which a director thinks about an actor. That's the point here, right? Actors are undisciplined. They don't have any particular goal on their own. They have certain kinds of talents, but they really need to be put in the right vehicle in order to function properly. And of course, they command a lot of money, more money than anybody else, certainly more money than the director does, because they are icons in the popular screen, right? They're the front people. Okay? The key thing then is the director has to figure out what is the appropriate role for this person in some narrative that will actually sell and be of some benefit to people. This is what the historian does, it seems to me, in acting in this positive role. Because it seems to me that we are hearing again and again, not just from the neuroscientists here, but also the neuroscientists that I talk to, and Paul Martin in a way kind of indicates this too, they don't know what the hell's going on. Right? They don't want to take responsibility for the narratives that are being told about them or the narratives that they're involved in or anything like that. Right? They're just as confused as the rest of us are. Well, we, the humanists, are the ones in the business of making sense of the larger context of history, and we have to somehow figure out a place to put these people. Right? Where they can function effectively. Where, as it were, their research actually has the relevant kind of meaning that we want it to have. Okay? That's a very important role. And that's, in fact, the way in which neuroscience gets integrated into academic knowledge. Right? Understanding this in the context, as Mark was mentioning, that the university is in crisis today. What exactly is it that the university is providing? Mark was pointing about how this translational science, where neuroscience is in the vanguard, might want to pull away from all this academic stuff and just become a kind of commercial enterprise. Well, then we, insofar as we're concerned about the future of knowledge as academics, we have got to find a more attractive role for these people. Okay? A role that actually makes sense of what they're doing, that goes beyond just the fact that neuroimaging is great for marketing, which I think is what's going to be the default position at the end of the day. Right? You scan brains and figure out what ads to put forward, and the neurostheticists seem to be very helpful in this regard. Okay? That if we're going to move away from that position and somehow see the contemporary neuroscience as part of some larger narrative of Western cultural history, then it's going to be the humanists who are going to provide that. So we're the directors, we're the script writers, and then the neuroscientists are the actors that we're bringing into play, which is to say, actors are difficult creatures to deal with, as we know, right? They're tricky people. They demand a lot, you know, they want to be respected as they are, there are all these other kinds of issues going on there, but nevertheless, right, they're the people, and they're the people who are going to sell the narrative too, right? The people are going to go to the movies because of the actors, not because of the director. They don't even know who the director is. Okay, so I do think that if one wants to think positively about this stuff, this is the model that one should work with here, and it has a kind of nice performative thing, to be politically correct. because I know performative is a word that everybody has to use these days, but so it has that character in a very literal way, in a way in which a lot of the other performative stuff doesn't. Because we're talking about film, theater, acting, etc. Okay? And I do think that this then provides a basis for re-legitimating the university, because the university is supposed to be the vanguard discipline, right, of the society, bringing the society forward. And that brings me to my second point here, which is, in a way, considering we've got a lot of historians here, I'm a little surprised that one name has not been mentioned so far. Let me just put him up here. Oops, sorry. Well, I know Schooley will know who he is, but...
Resmond sounds better than Raymond.
What?
Resmond sounds better.
Well, how many of you know who this guy is? Not that many. I'm taping this. No, because this is the man. If you want to talk about a man in the history of neuroscience, right, who actually was a kind of world historic figure who was thinking about the kinds of things we're talking about here, this is the man, right? And was rector of the University of Berlin in 1880. Okay, and this is a very important guy, and was very concerned, in a way, about the issue Schooley was raising yesterday against our Freudian colleague here. Namely, this idea of the human body as a conductor of electricity. That was kind of what his research was all about. Okay, and he was a very interesting figure. He gave this very famous speech in 1880 about the seven world riddles. The seven world riddles... Which these are the things that science supposedly will never be able to solve. Okay? And they're the usual suspects from a philosophical standpoint. You know, the nature of mind, you know, how did the universe begin, all this kind of stuff. And he was given a very robust response by Ernst Haeckel, Darwin's biggest defender in Germany at the time. Now, this whole debate about what it is that science can know and not know was something that, if you think about, so this is happening in the 1880s, right? For the logical positivists, as they're young people, they are very influenced by this kind of discussion about what the limits of science happens to be. Now, the interesting thing about that kind of debate is the fact that Dubois-Raymond really thought that as a neuroscientist of his time, he was well positioned to make this point. And that has a lot to do with what the status of the brain was, okay? And there we're talking about the brain as, in some sense, a translation device, you know, of mind and matter. Right? So there's a sense in which Dubois-Raymond quite clearly still, even though he is normally seen as a materialist, nevertheless still held on to some notion that there was this kind of transcendent kind of entity that couldn't be understood exclusively or entirely in terms of material conditions, but nevertheless the brain was the sort of transformer of this. And it was in this context very often that the concept of energy was used, and Schooley was alluding to a lot of the history that was surrounding this at the time. And Haeckel was a much more straightforward materialist. Okay, didn't think that there was anything special there. And you see, in the title of my talk, I mentioned the business about the brain, but not life as we know it. Because the brain has always had a very particular kind of position in the discussions of the mind-body problem. It isn't just the body. Okay? The brain has always been seen as a kind of what I guess, you know, one might call within science studies a boundary object. Because in a sense, even though it is material, it's always been seen as kind of the translation point. And so people who, like Dubois-Raymond, who did have ambitions for how the university should be reconfigured in light of all the emergence of natural sciences, because he was very much a defender of the natural sciences taking over the place of the human sciences... Right. Nevertheless, he believed that part of what you took over was the spiritual function. You didn't eliminate it, you took it over. Okay, and that's quite a different thing from Haeckel, who basically thought that in a sense, you know, the more materialism you have, the less the spirit matters. It's not that knowing more about brain science will explain spirituality, but rather it'll eliminate the need for spirituality as something to be explained. Okay, and those are two quite different issues here, especially in the context of the contemporary discussion with regard to neurophilosophy, a la Patricia Churchland, who's much more on Heckel's side of the issue. Right? Namely, the more you know about brain science, the less there is a need to explain some of the things that we traditionally thought had to be explained. Now, the interesting thing about Dubois-Raymond as well, and I bring this up here, is he was also part of another dispute, which I think is very crucial for those of us who feel that the difference between the human and the natural sciences is significant. So let me conjure up the name of another person from that period who's not come up yet. Oh, sorry, just dealing with a German typewriter. Wilhelm Dilthey. And the interesting question here, and here I'm drawing on a series of papers that came out in the Journal of the History of the Human Sciences in the early 2000s by Ermeline Weidbrauser, who's a German who's expatriated in Melbourne, Australia. And there it's about the origin and the canonization within the university structure of Germany of the human and natural sciences. And she focuses on the different ways in which one might think about biology. You know, the discipline of biology, which is just emerging at that time. The word biology is coined by Lamarck in the early 19th century, and by the late 19th century is finally becoming a kind of discipline. And so then the question becomes, how to think about biology? Because somebody like Dilthey, who we think about as very closely associated with Verstehen, sympathetic understanding, and all of these these classically humanistic methods for studying human beings, believed that the possibility that, let's say, that we could reenact the thoughts of somebody's mind from the distant past relied ultimately on the fact that there was species unity of human beings. Right? So in other words, there was a biological foundation to this, which had to do with species unity. Okay, and so in that respect, there was to be a foundational science of biology that would underwrite the human sciences. It wouldn't be the biology we have now, but it would be a biology that would be much closer, perhaps to maybe some of you know this guy. Oh, sorry, the man of the Mittwelt and that kind of theoretical biology, Uexküll, who Ernst Cassirer talks about, this idea of a kind of a... This man is normally seen nowadays, I suppose, as the founder of zoobiosemiotics, right? The idea that the way that you understand the organism is in terms of its environmental transactions. Right, so you understand the perception and cognitive systems of organisms in terms of how they relate to the environment, and then you can generate the kind of knowledge that's appropriate to them by virtue of the capacity. Right, so every species, as it were, has its own worldview. Okay, and human beings have their worldview because of their particular perceptual and cognitive capacities, which are universalizable across individuals of the species. Okay? Dilthey held this view. And it seems to me that if you believe that it's possible to have anything like Verstehen or sympathetic understanding across generations, across cultures, across time, that in some sense you need some sort of a biological foundation. And it was this kind of biological foundation that Dilthey was imagining. And obviously this would have a strong neuropsychological component to it. And so in a sense there was a placeholder in his system for that. And so for people who continue to be relativists today and want to invoke Dilthey, the point is the relativism, as it were, is grounded in a larger universalism about the nature of human perceptual and cognitive capacities of the sort that, let's say, the neuroaestheticists are getting at. Okay, so in other words, I don't see, so whatever the neuro, there's a lot of, neuroaesthetics may scandalize people, but the point is, I do think that that, in a sense, may be a latter-day version of the kind of thing that Dilthey was talking about as grounding the possibility for sympathetic understanding across cultures. But Dubois-Raymond thought about things quite differently. He's one of the people who argued for the reduction of biology to physics. So in other words, biology is not the foundation of the human sciences, but rather you have, as the logical positivists were to promote, the idea that you have one set of sciences with physics as the foundation. So there's not two sciences, just one science. And the interesting thing there was, he thought, that people who focus very much on the biological side of things were fetishizing what was really important about human beings. So in other words, you might say Dubois-Raymond imagined that the fact that we had the material capacities that we have now is just a contingent feature of evolutionary history. And so why should we then sort of say that's the end of it all? And so one of the reasons why he was interested in the electrical transmission through the human body was he somehow believed that in a sense the electricity as a universal force might be important in terms of understanding the nature of life in general as such. And that human beings, as it were, is just one transmitter. A very complex transmitter, more complex, let's say, than a radio, but nevertheless a transmitter. Okay? And so he was imagining, in a sense, that the fetishization of the human body was kind of the problem here, and that what one should imagine is that really what we're trying to understand is what is the nature of, you know, force understood in this very universal sense as a capacity to create, to be, to think, etc. And it is a kind of divine impulse kind of idea. Okay? And I think that is, in a sense, where one should think about, you know, if one wants to talk about what reductionism is about, reductionism is not about, in the sense that Dubois-Raymond was promoting, is not about a fetishism of matter, but rather this idea that all forms of matter are, as it were, transitional or intermediate to somehow some notion of whatever mind, one might say, inhabits and gives life to the universe. That, and I think that's kind of the way in which it was taken. Now, it doesn't make for neat academic disciplinary distinctions, but I think that that's kind of where he was going with this sort of idea. And I think one thing here that's very interesting is if you think about the fetishization of the brain, isn't so much because people are so concerned about preserving the human body as such, but rather often what they're imagining is that the brain could be attached to something else that, as it were, can continue whatever the brain can produce more effectively. Right? So the people who are brain fetishists are not body fetishists in the same sense. Okay? So what's interesting about the brain is that at the moment it's the most efficient way of conducting whatever we regard as valuable, but in the future, perhaps through cryogenics, as Guy was pointing out with Ted Williams, you know, or some other means, right, there might be some more efficient way of conducting the same thing, whether we call it electricity or information or computation or whatever. And so in that respect, I think the brain, you know, provides a very interesting kind of marker with regard to what the point of doing science is. Okay? And I think it's one that detaches itself somewhat from a kind of biological understanding of the human body. And if you look at within the philosophical literature, for example, you see that there's a lot of discussion about brains in a vat. We don't talk about hearts in a vat. We don't talk about legs in a vat. We talk about brains in a vat, right? Because there's some sense in which there can be some semantic relationship to the world established by a brain by itself, in some sense, radically disconnected from a normal human body, you know, in the way in which we couldn't say about any other organ of the human body. Okay, so the point of the brain here, it seems to me, is quite important from the standpoint of what the history of science is supposed to be about. I know, I only have 5 minutes, I know, I realize that. I don't want to go on too long. But then this brings me to my last point, and it's a point that this gentleman here in the back with the eyeglasses, you sir, you raised yesterday in response to their talk, and this has to do with the shift from the brain to the neuro, and what the significance of that is, okay? And I think that the fixation on the brain in the past, and with someone like Dubois-Raymond and other people who were, I think we would call now neuroscientists, but nevertheless did have a kind of brain fixation, was that the brain was kind of the place where the God moment occurred, right? It was somehow implanted in us. And if you want to know what the historical precedent for this idea, if you... Emanuel Swedenborg. I don't know if you, those of you who know something about the history of neuroscience, there's this historian of neuroscience at Princeton, Charles Gross, who's written a bit about Swedenborg as being the person who really put the brain on the map, as it were, as the transmission point between God and reality. And Immanuel Kant, you know, who talked about the spirit seekers toward the end of his life, was very much captivated by Swedenborg. As someone who in a sense, got that kind of idea. And while this idea was regarded as kind of mystical in its time, I think this is the kind of idea I've been talking about so far. It's basically this kind of brain-led idea that somehow, when you secularize the idea that we're creating the image and likeness of God, how does that get secularized in any kind of scientifically tractable terms? It's brain science. And once you figure out the nature of the brain, you figure out our divine possibilities. You figure out the potential that needs to be unleashed. And of course, that discourse is with us still today. Okay? But that is different from the neurodiscourse that's around now. And that's the point I want to end with here, because that gentleman raised a very interesting point. The neurodiscourse that we have now tends to see the brain not so much as this translation point or this point of agency, as it were, but more as a site, as a place. The brain is the place where all these neurons collect together. It's kind of like a train station, a central train station. Okay? And in that respect, the brain doesn't have any agency of its own. It's just a point where other kinds of networks feed into it and then registers the response to it. And if you think about the parallel distributed processing models of the brain that started to become very popular in the 1980s and still are, I think, are very dominant today. This is very important from the standpoint of the history of cognitive science, right? That parallel distributed processing is pretty much what replaced the top-down AI models that Herbert Simon and other people were advocating from the 50s into the 70s, that basically said there was a central cognitive processing that determined everything that happened in the organism. Instead, what you have are nerves that are neurons that are coming from many different directions, right, each of which are very directly in interfacing with the environment and then feeding upward into the central location where they then get synthesized in some fashion, and that then becomes thought, right? That's the parallel distributed processing model, basically, which I think is still very much dominant today. And I do think that does amount to a very substantial change. This is not the notion of the brain that Dubois, Raymond, and all these other guys were talking about. Okay? And here, I will just end here, that and to connect it up with the neoliberalism conspiracy theory that was just floated, this book, this is the book to look at. If I can get it written. By Hayek. The Sensory Order by Friedrich Hayek in 1952. This is the urtext for this kind of thinking, okay? Where what you have is the brain as basically, you might say, the embodied marketplace where all the different stimuli enter in and then get resolved in some fashion, and then that becomes your thinking. Just like how a price emerges in the marketplace. Okay? And it's all there, and Hayek is drawing on the neuroscience of his time, which is pretty primitive, but nevertheless he's drawing on it. And I would suggest to you that kind of notion of neuroscience, where the brain is just a receptacle for all of these different sensations coming in, where the brain is a kind of a conglomeration of networks, but that's where it comes from in terms of legitimation, and because it goes very much against the whole grain of the way of thinking about the mind up to that point. And I do think it is a different model from a model that's based on the brain. That the brain-based model that I was talking about earlier, that in a way was thinking of itself as a successor to the humanities, providing guidance to the university, is one that in a way sees the brain semi-detached from the body. Whereas in the case of the sensory order, Hayek's view of the brain is very much one with the body and one with nature. And where there's no special place attributed to the brain. It just happens to be the place where the neurons are the densest. There's nothing qualitatively different about it. Okay? And I do think that's kind of where we are, you know, because what I'm trying to do, what I've been trying to do in this talk, is in a sense to give you larger meta-narratives into which one might think about what's going on in brain science and neuroscience today. And I do think there's a sense in which there are competing narratives. One that, in a sense, would stress the brain, and I think actually would be a more progressive narrative, and then one which, in a sense, would take a more laid-back view of the brain, not as an agent, not as it were the vanguard of the human condition, but rather as it were just a site where all of our stimulation comes in and somehow gets synthesized in some way. And I think that's a much more passive view, but one that I think fits very well with a kind of neoliberal market view that's very dominant in general in the culture today. And I'll stop with that. Yes, I didn't say I was providing the whole story.
No, but there was a crucial. It's interesting to me that one moves from the history of ideas to neurology, and to a neurohistory, let's say, right? And it seems to me that there is a crucial, and that the same thing happened when this were active directors, the heroic individuals, and now this changed roles. But what about the social historical context in which we live, and its constraints, and the kind of situation, let's say, violence or the power relations in the world today? This was kind of curiously vacant, vacated, let's say, from your talk.
You're absolutely right, and I said that. The point is, I don't disagree with this point, but there is an issue about what accounts for things like the timing under which social change occurs, given that the ideas are around all the time.
Well, are they?
What?
Are the ideas? I disagree with the idea that we're all.
Oh, I don't actually think that the Enlightenment ideas that people were standing for in the late 18th century that led to the revolutions, they were not invented overnight. They had been around for a long time, and there is a question about why people act on them at a particular point. Just like there are lots of ideas that, in a sense, we're quite willing to entertain, you know, for fictional purposes, you might say, or for talking amongst ourselves, but nevertheless we would never act on. Okay, but every now and then people do act on things, and one needs to know something about the motivational factors involved. And of course they're not exclusively related to diet, but diet is an important point. I didn't mean to leave out the other stuff. But look, you know as well as I do that within the history of Marxism, there's an enormous amount of discussion about the timing of revolution. And always Marxists are dithering about stuff, right? Say, well, is this the right time? Are the social conditions in place? And you begin to think that maybe the Marxists don't have the whole story here. Okay, and so it seems to me that there's nothing wrong with adding this into the mix. And of course, I only have 20, 25 minutes to talk. I can't talk about how this would fit into an overall Marxist story. But you better not leave this out, it seems to me, if you really are talking about, you know, using history as a basis for enacting change. You have to know something about the things that are in people's bodies. Okay, and it's more than just the ideas that are around them. That you know, I would say with regard to that, and with regard to conspiracy theories, I don't see them in a negative way. When I call something a conspiracy theory, that's not necessarily negative. I mean, so I don't mean to be offensive on that regard.
Yeah. I think I had Gouldy in the back, but
Let him talk.
Okay, but. Yeah, running out
of time. I'll keep quiet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you for your talk. If I hear you correctly, in terms of the stomach, the brain, and the body being all of a piece, aren't you then partly saying that we have to consider us as Darwinian creatures, and in that sense very deeply materialistic with an open future? And the second question, comment, is that in some sense, there is, there can often be quite a lot of pain in the brain, but somehow there are no psychological or psychiatric institutions in your presentation,
yes.
Or say, and I'll finish on that, or to think of, say, prisons in the United States where you have so much psychiatric violence and so much pain and destruction, and would it be helpful and interesting to include that in your narrative, the second point, plus the Darwinism,
okay.
Which I know you are.
Okay, look. I'm not a Darwinist. that's the first point. I mean, if you got kind of the drift of my talk, I'm a bit sympathetic to Dubois-Raymond's view in the sense that I don't believe that, you know, that the interesting thing about the brain is more the way in which it distinguishes us from other animals than how it brings us back to other animals. And this is why I made this distinction between the Dubois-Raymond viewpoint and the viewpoint that I associated at the end with Hayek. Because I do think at the moment, the neuroscience that we're studying tends to be more like the Hayek viewpoint, where the brain is just a site for neural configurations to occur. Okay, and neurology is understood as a sort of generalized network phenomena. But the whole idea of focusing on the brain was that the brain was a very distinctive kind of organ that, in a sense, had powers that could perhaps be preserved even outside the human body. Now, this is not because I necessarily believe these claims, but because I do think that the way it gets you to think about human beings, you know, takes you into, I think, the level that is what science is about, which is to understand the nature of reality. Right? And so the fixation on the brain has to do with the idea that there is this organ that if we understood it, we'd be able to understand the possibilities for everything that can be. Okay? And I do think that there are these two different notions of the history of what we call neuroscience that one could be drawing on. One which is this heroic view that Émile Dubois-Raymond represented, and the other which is the view that Hayek represents, which I think is becoming more dominant now, which is more of a Darwinian view, actually. Okay? And in a way, the brain is not special.
Okay.
The pain? No, there's an issue about the length of time I have to talk about this stuff. I mean, there are things missing, obviously. I'm trying to emphasize the things that I think need to be said here. I mean, there are a lot of things other people can talk to more directly, but these are the things that I wanted to say in this context.
Okay. You were next to one is.
I can see it. So.
Oh, no. Go ahead. Nothing.
Go ahead.
So, yesterday we were called rich, we were called sexy. Today we were called divas bordering divinity with God complex.
Yeah, no problem.
But at the same time, I wonder in the terms of the actor and director metaphor that you use. Usually the director
Yes.
But in the case of historians versus neuroscientists, statistical and mathematical and...
That's not the script, though. That's not the script. The script is the narrative.
All right. The content that is going on there is just not accessible to the field of history. So if I want to speak also metaphorically, it would seem more like a reality show rather than a director actor model, where actually the content of what neuroscientists are doing is not as much in the hands of the director, so to speak.
Well, okay. I would say this, that if you look at the, again, I realize it's not fashionable to look at terms of the long expanse of history, the aspects of science that have in fact been intellectually and culturally influential aren't necessarily the aspects of it that have tested or validated it. Okay, so in other words, the kinds of things that sort of technical detail that, let's say, a scientist would need to know in order to tell the difference between whether a particular theory is good or bad, or a particular finding is good or bad, is not necessarily part of this kind of narrative that's being forged. In a sense, the scientist's technical knowledge is a bit like the actor's method acting.
The interesting thing is that scientists are telling their own narratives themselves right now.
Sure.
Whether it's in the media, whether it's in high-ranking journals, whether...
I understand. And that's because there's a vacuum of leadership on our side. No, seriously. No, that's what I would say. I would say in response, it's not that I have anything against scientists doing this. I have nothing against scientists doing this. But I do think the fact that the scientists are in so much control of their own narratives in that respect, even to the exclusion of their colleagues, and you think of Richard Dawkins as a representative of evolutionary biology, some people cringe, right? But the point is, where are the humanists? The humanists ought to be on this.
I agree.
Right?
And, well, we have got complex.
No, but the point is, I think that this is where we ought to be. It's not to deny the scientists they're doing this, but this is where we ought to be. We ought to be the directors. We ought to be providing the scripts. And that ought to be the positive side of all this. Because I do think a lot, especially, see, neuroscience in particular, I think every neuroscientist you talk to, you know, and I think this is true from what we said now, that these people are looking for narratives in a sense, and they'll go for whatever is available, but of course we know more sophisticated things, in principle at least, that we could be providing as a narrative within which what they're talking about fits, and we should be thinking about doing that as part of what our job is, integrating it into the general cultural history.
Which kind of film director?
I know. Exactly. And I want you to think along those lines.
No, this is a fair question. Because
it is.
Avatar was a terrible movie.
No, exactly.
And what I'd like to know is, aren't you giving us the kind of...
David Cronenberg.
...thing back?
David Cronenberg. Stanley Kubrick. There you go. That's what we should be.
Why then? What suddenly made them appear...
No, I'm just giving you my own personal view. But the point is, I do think that once we start... But once we start thinking along these lines, then we can start having sensible discussions about what standards are and all that, because there will be a model for talking about the relationship between the humanist and the natural science, which we do not have at the moment. At the moment, it's just this kind of ambient, critical, skeptical bullshit, right? Which is great for a couple of books, but you know, you can't... You know, there's a sense in which after a while it does not become a very productive relationship. Okay, that's all I'm saying. That if we do engage in this relationship, we can start asking your questions and, you know, dealing with your questions sensibly, because I think it's a real question. So I'm not sloughing it off. But the point is, you have to accept the position first. You have to accept that you are indeed a director, and then you think, what kind of a director am I, and who are the actors am I dealing with? Are my neuroscientists like, what? You know, are they Robert De Niro? Are they Marlon Brando? I mean, who are these guys? It's not bizarre, because what we don't have at the moment is any adequate model of the relationship between the human and natural scientists, other than this kind of standoffish thing.
But what teaches directors? I mean, I don't want to be a director.
Because in fact, the humanists have been most effective within the academy, vis-a-vis society at large, in terms of providing the meta-narratives. I know this is a very unfashionable thing to say, but this is what the humanists do best in terms of justifying their position to the larger society, is providing the meta-narratives. And I know we've abdicated this with postmodernism to a large extent, but this is, in fact, you want to talk about how you justify your place in the university, this is what you do.
Observing,
I hope someone pays you for it.
Well, I don't
No, but see, seriously, we do need to establish there's a serious sociological question here within this group of what our relationship is with these neuroscientists.
Okay, I think Fernando would have a question.
Well, I'll try to make my 3 points fairly fast. First, neurohistory. I was pained to see that you took from Snail's book one of the most ludicrous and easy to disprove examples. It is really ridiculous the way, you know, Snail uses this whole coffee coming in. I mean, you know, Rousseau was not a coffee drinker and he was one of the main, you know, figures of the Enlightenment. Okay, let's just complete.
But Rousseau wasn't there in 1789 either, so Rousseau is not really the guy you're supposed to be talking about.
He was a major.
Yes, he was a major thinker, but he wasn't a major doer.
He was dead by then, but you know. I'm just saying that, of course, you know, any social economic historian can say something about, you know, the effects of diet, and I mean, I think anthropologists and economists, and everybody knows.
Why are you trivializing this?
I'm saying that it is a completely ludicrous, absurd thing.
You are trivializing it, then, aren't you?
No, I'm not trivializing. We could spend, you know, the next entire day, you know, providing serious historical arguments, you know, against males.
But not Rousseau. Rousseau was not involved in the French Revolution.
I guess Rousseau was a major figure in the French Revolution. What do you mean? All revolutionaries are invoking Rousseau all the time.
They're invoking... No, but you want to know what the revolutionaries ate, not what Rousseau ate.
Yeah, but hold on. First of all, you know, just any economic historian is going to tell you that in spite of the masses of coffee coming in, it's a minority of individuals who are drinking coffee. Anyway, let's not go there.
And same thing for the French Revolution, but go ahead.
I just wanted
it's not like everybody's revolting in France.
I just wanted to point this out. The second point, and it remains in the realm of, you know, reasonable, well-grounded history, is the Swedenborg point. Yes, Swedenborg is a very interesting author. Swedenborg wrote several psychologists in Latin at a time when, you know, psychology was at an interesting turning point and so on. But frankly, Swedenborg is a completely absent figure from the history of the neurosciences or brain science.
It's true.
And psychology, mm-hmm. and so on. So you just cannot tell that story. There is a much more historically grounded, let's put it, dependable story, which it's not publicity, but you know, I wrote a 500-book page about, which just came out of Chicago University Press, called The Sciences of the Soul, 16th to 18th Century. Swedenborg is not mentioned, not because I don't know Swedenborg, but because he played no role. So this is a nice gimmick, you know, to bring in...
Okay, go ahead.
...into the history, but it's completely out of place.
I think part of where you have to look for the history of the development of brain science and mind science is also through religion and theology, and Swedenborg is influential there.
Of course, that is an absolutely essential point. But, you know,
and with Immanuel Kant too. I mean,
but things in history just don't happen like, okay, you know, a boat of caffeine came in and then.
I wasn't saying that, but I was drawing attention to the...
Or Swedenborg had some vision.
Look, the fact that I didn't talk about everything in the world in this talk, come on. I was talking about the things I think needed to be said, but of course I don't disagree with you on that.
Of course, but you chose to talk,
yes,
about things that are...
Because of the response that you would give, that you would just dismiss it. I mean...
No, I'm not dismissing them. I have very lengthy arguments why. And then the third point, which is also historical and that touches on director, actor, very interesting, I think proposal is that historians have already documented the extent to which the neurosciences are dependent on the human sciences. All of the basic questions, and I'm not talking, when I say basic questions, I'm talking about basic conceptual questions, I'm not talking about questions about, you know, particular experimental setups or particular circuits in the brain where things are supposed to be happening. But the questions they are talking about, they are all borrowed from psychology,
sure,
and from sociology.
Yes.
So the humanities are already playing a role, but this role is not being recognized because the neurosciences tend to turn around the epistemic hierarchy of knowledge.
But this is not their job is not to be responsible to the epistemic hierarchy. This is our job. We're the ones who should be doing the job of sorting things out, not them.
Yeah, but the problem is that if you bring the sort are, like, I'm not going to name them, which is public relations officers.
No, but that's the point. You don't need to be. There are alternative meta-narratives. This is what I was proposing here.
We're waiting for them.
Okay, but the point is that that is a role. No, but I agree with you. That is a concern.
That is not the role. We are not here to provide meta-narratives for neurosciences. We're here to do a job, which is, not to provide meta-narrative for somebody else, but to do what we know how to do.
But the meta-narratives aren't for them, they include them. They are for the larger society. Again, the relation between the director and the actor. The director does not put on a film on behalf of the actor. The actor is a vehicle by which the film gets made, which is for the benefit of the public, supposedly.
No,
right, and that's the point.
No, the director does the film because he's in there to make money even if less than the actor. And this is what's been happening to the people who have been...
Look, but you're just too cynical for words, I mean...
at the London School of Economics and other places, as doing exactly what you claim. What they are doing is just simply placing themselves in the role of the actor, of the director, who's benefiting from the major producer.
Come on.
Bringing in a lot of money.
There are a lot of bad eggs in the world. Come on. But the point is, just because there are bad examples doesn't...
It's not bad examples. It's the only ones that there are.
But look, we can set our own example. You make it sound like we always have to be following.
I'm not following.
I have a few more questions on my list, but I think it's better just to...
Stop that.
How do I shut this? I want to save this, and I have a thing. Well, what I was going to say is that...
Can you do something?
Let me save this into my. I have a little thing here.
Is it
public? It's public.
Is it public?
My disc is called public. Okay.
Okay. What I was going to say was that the questions they should be asked in the final discussion. Okay.